Welcome to the RKOT podcast. I'm Mike Lavelle, and this is the first of a number of interviews I'm conducting with key figures in industrial archaeology over the last 50 years in Northwest England. And it's my great pleasure to have for this first podcast on industrial archaeology, David George, an old friend of mine. David and I go back quite a few years, back to the 1990s. But David is one of the few people still working in the northwest of England whose experience of industrial archaeology goes back to pretty much the very beginning of the discipline, which is why I thought it'd be quite fun for us to talk this morning, David.
Good morning.
Obviously, you grew up in Cumbria, a fabulous county, which most people tend to think of as being natural rather than man-made. But you and I both know that there's a huge amount of industrial archaeology up in Cumbria. But what I wanted to talk to you about this morning was your role in industrial archaeology and in promoting industrial archaeology when you left Cumbria and came to Manchester back in the 1960s.
Yes. Now, I came here in 66 to a new college called the John Dalton College of Technology on Oxford Road, and I was appointed as a lecturer in what they then called interdisciplinary studies. And I had floated industrial archaeology at the interview, so I was looking forward to developing something in those areas.
So that was back in 66, and you were using the phrase industrial archaeology?
Yes.
How did they react to that?
The structure of the college was that when it was in its early days, there were only a few degree students, and they were London University externals. But the vast majority of students were what were called advanced technology courses in engineering, chemicals, business studies, and within the programs for those students there was an option system. In other words, once a week for a couple of hours, a range of options was laid before the students, which they could choose on a termly basis. After one term they could switch to another option. These were under the heading what were called complementary studies.
Right. Okay. So, and you were able to shoehorn your interest in industrial
archaeology. Yes. So this was an opportunity to put together two varieties of industrial archaeology. I had the cooperation of the new Northwest Museum of Science and Industry, which was just across the road from John Dalton, and they agreed to take students once a term, under the heading History of Science and Technology in the Northwest. And back at the college, I would provide a more general industrial archaeology course. So students had the opportunity of one or the other and then switching the next term back again. Those two courses complemented each other and it worked very well. And we usually had a fairly good number of students in the programmes.
You'd already done industrial archaeology when you were in Cumbria, hadn't you?
Yes, I'd already taught at my own college and also for WEA.
So what topics in industrial archaeology were you picking up in the 60s?
Well, very much, you know, along the lines of Hudson's book, topics by industry, ranging from textiles to coal mining and so on. Now, eventually, a small number of students might become quite enthusiastic. And I still meet people who say to me, I remember when I was in your industrial archaeology course. A small number of students would be quite enthusiastic. So small groups were formed from these classes who went out to do some recording, primarily photographic, in and around Manchester. Obviously, the two-hour period put limits on the geographical spread. But What the students employed, apart from cameras, was the new CBA record card.
I was going to ask about that.
So part of the exercise, having taken the photograph, was for them to complete a whole range of CBA record cards. And those cards eventually, with the photographs, became part of the Marais archive at Chetham's.
Of course, this is in the days before computers were commonplace in archaeology or indeed in history. So we are talking, I've seen some of these cards. We're talking about an A4 sheet, aren't we?
No, that was the later version. I think that was the later version. The AIA did revive the idea of recording sheets.
Yes, they did.
But the original CBA card was just, 6 inches by 3 inches?
Oh, the classic little index cards.
That's right. And you filled in the basic information about the site and dating and location and so on. A photograph could be attached to the back.
Now, I have seen some of those in the Council of British Archaeology headquarters in York, in their archive for the North West.
It was a simple way for students to record what they'd been doing.
Of course, these days we put it on the historic environment record. But back then, all paper.
And of course, this is very, very much recording and outline surveys, and the idea of excavation developed somewhat later.
Now, you and I both know that the excavation side of industrial archaeology is very important. I think many people's image, I suspect, of industrial archaeology is standing structures, particularly mills or mines.
Yes.
But excavating was something that was always at the back of the minds of quite a number of those earlier industrial archaeologists. Excavating sites which had been demolished or were partially demolished. Now, I know you were involved in several early industrial archaeology excavations.
Well, I wanted to go one better after these recording activities and actually set up some kind of an industrial archaeology excavation to which students could volunteer to participate. It had to be at weekends so as not to disrupt the normal timetable. And the opportunity arose with roadworks in West Cumbria at a place called Bridgeport.
So the Cumbrian connection again.
And after somewhat lengthy negotiations with county planning, the county architect, the contractors, who were very cooperative, I was able to take students to a fenced-off site to spend two long weekends excavating the site of an 18th-century coal mine. I think we were very lucky in that a local man who lived nearby had spare accommodation and agreed to accommodate the students for a couple of nights at a time, to save travelling, obviously. And I stayed with one of my ex-colleagues from Workington College. We were fortunate with the weather. Dr. Hills came up from the Museum of Science and Industry to interpret what we were doing and what we were finding. And incidentally, this was a mixed group, boys and girls. And eventually, some of our discoveries, some of the objects were taken back to the Museum of Science and Industry.
Now, this is Real Fitz Pitt, isn't it? The pumping engine site.
Yes, the name of the site was Real Fitz Pitt. It was a late 18th century coal mine. It was threatened by bridge works and road extensions.
And that would be in 73, 74?
That was 75, 76.
Right.
It was backed, the whole exercise was backed, fortunately, by Professor Donald Carbrell at UMIST, who underwrote the costs.
And it's still one of the very few 18th century colliery pumping engines that have actually been excavated in the UK.
Yes, I think so.
There's a number that have been done since, but certainly in Northwest terms, there are only two other sites I can think of which have been excavated. One is Jane Pitt in Workington, and the other is Fairbottom Bob's in Parkbridge, Greater Manchester.
Correct.
Bearing in mind that there are hundreds, well, we know there were hundreds of colliery steam engines installed in the Northwest in the 18th century. What did the students get out of that dig then, from your point of view?
As I say, I still meet the occasional student who were in these courses or took part in these activities. Well, it's an enhancement of their basic college course, isn't it? It extends their know-how and experience. The next opportunity was Fairbottom Bob's, which was a kind of mixed activity involving the Manchester Region Industrial Archaeology Society, but also some students who volunteered as well.
Now, of course, Fairbottom Bob's much, much closer to what would be the Polytechnic, Manchester Polytechnic, by then, when you're looking at it.
Yes. By 68, I'd become the field secretary of the Manchester Region Industrial Archaeology Society. And we were approached by the Medlock Tame Conservation Trust, who were beginning to make plans for the restoration of the Parkbridge area and its opening up as a visitor experience. Would we have a go at laying bare the famous Fairbottom Bob's? Now, you had to have a certain amount of faith, because the story was that it had all been removed to the States by Henry Ford.
As listeners to this podcast will know, because I've talked about the later excavations at Fairbottom Bob's in 1999 and 2000.
Yes, so in the early 80s, we had a go at the Fairbottom Bob's site, and at that time, there was still a cottage on the site, and there were materials which had been preserved by the tenant of the cottage, pieces not having been taken away to Dearborn.
Well, these are actually pieces from the engine.
Yes, and we were able to demonstrate that, in particular, the chimney could be located and repaired. And the boiler, we were able to uncover the foundations of the boiler house, which was a replacement wagon boiler, and we did tackle largely that part of the site, the foundations of the wagon boiler. And during the excavation, a metal object was found which it seemed to date the installation of that boiler, which would have been a replacement, I think, from the original haystack boiler. Adjacent to the cylinder housing, there was a curved wall which seemed to indicate the site of the original wagon boiler.
Well, when we went back in 1999-2000 to excavate that completely, we had Marias members on board again,
yes,
as well as students, sort of repeating that mix. But we couldn't have done that without that earlier work.
Yes, your colleague John Roberts made great use of the photographs taken during the original
excavation. He did indeed, yes. He had a lot of fun doing that, yes. yes, and of course the steam engine is, the foundations are still on display today, sort of, oh gosh, 20 years after that second lot of work.
So talking about Marias field activities, apart from that original Fairbottom Bob's dig, I arranged a tie-up with the Manchester Photographic Society, who would join forces with interested members from the Industrial Archaeology Society to do some more recording in central Manchester. And the idea was to target specifically important sites like Castlefield and the Ancoats Mills. It was good having people with photographic knowledge who were able to record the Castleford Canal Basin and the Ancoats Mills as complementary to what students had been doing on a small scale earlier. So again, the society benefited in terms of its archives from those joint activities with the Manchester Photographic Society.
And this is back in the '70s when the Rochdale Canal was abandoned, and I remember as a teenager seeing some canal hulks.
Castlefield very run down, the whole area, but we did manage to get into the merchant's warehouse for some interior shots.
Was that before it burnt down?
Yes.
Should just say that it went on to be conserved and restored, but that's of course the value of this early work to getting in places.
We had the blessing of Owen Ashmore and his colleagues, and also there was a lady called Sylvia Clark, who at the time was lecturing at Salford College of Advanced Technology. And so, as well as, if you like, lay members and photographers turning out, we had the support of some of the academics as well.
Of course, Owen Ashmore is one of those founding figures of industrial archaeology in the Northwest from the 60s and 70s.
And he did a lot to encourage this kind of field work. This kind of activity recording. It was always a minority interest of members of societies who, by and large, were happy to listen to lectures or go to day schools.
I think that's the great benefit of setting up a society like Marias to really focus on recording and promoting industrial archaeology, because Marias goes back to 1966, doesn't it?
Yes.
So a couple of years before you joined.
And has a very impressive, as you know, Mike, because you've made use of it, a very impressive collection of data.
Absolutely. That's come in handy on several occasions when I've been researching material for Association for Industrial Archaeology conferences in Manchester and some of my own research and books. So yes, of course, should say Marias is still going today.
Yes, and I've got that archive began life at the Museum of Science and Industry, the new Museum of Science and Industry at Castlefield.
In the 1830 station.
Eventually a committee of Marias decided to move it to Chetham's. Apparently we'd had a favourable offer from Chetham's to house the archive, and since then they've been very supportive. I've added to it because I am now the honorary archivist for Marias. I've added extensively to that archive over the years, particularly archaeological reports written by professionals and others. I've made a substantial collection of, getting on now for some 200 archaeological reports, some of which are probably not in Norman Redhead's archive.
Norman, of course, being the recently retired county archaeologist for Greater Manchester. Perhaps we could alert his successor, Ian Miller, to the archive.
Indeed, and my colleague Tony Wright only recently sent a report on Trafford Park, a survey of Trafford Park to Ian, when we heard that he'd been commissioned to update the listing.
The local listing for Trafford, yes. That's a project that's still going on. In fact, that reminds me, I've got some stuff to do on that myself. You mentioned Owen Ashmore earlier on. Now, I know Owen Ashmore was responsible for promoting extramural courses in the area, wasn't he?
Well, Owen was, that's right, the head of the Department of Extramural Studies. There was a very extensive programme for some years, as I say, running from Blackburn in the north to Cheadle, Hume and Cheshire in the south. Obviously, there were several tutors. Now, some of those tutors, in addition to myself, some of those tutors were recruited from Marais, like the late Harold Norris, who by trade was an auctioneer.
But he had a particular expertise, didn't he?
He had a particular expertise in the Cheshire Watermill.
Publishing the first detailed survey, if I remember
rightly. Yes. He'd also recorded the Cromford, in detail, the Cromford and High Peak Railway, I remember. And he was an example of someone recruited from Marais to provide extramural courses. There were always a few writers and surveyors in Marais. Another one was Roger Holden, of course, who was published on the architecture of textile mills.
Yes, his most recent stuff has been on fustian mills and fustian production. I think that probably emphasises the real value of a local society like Marais, where you have a focus on regional and local standing buildings and industrial structures, because it's that local sensibility.
And after all, really, Marais owes its existence to the success of adult education courses, from which, having people's enthusiasm having been raised, they join a society. That was how it worked in that period, that the best recruiting method, recruiting ground for local industrial archaeology societies were these adult education and WEA courses.
Workers' Education Association, of course, still run archaeology courses in Northwest England. I'm very fortunate to be able to teach these days online several industrial archaeology courses. Whether that leads to people joining societies still, I'm not sure.
Not necessarily, because you've got all the online side of things.
It's a different environment these days.
Yes, yes, yes. But we still, Marais has still got 70 members and still running a very successful lecture programme.
And still doing fieldwork?
Not so much. The fieldwork side of... Well, there've been some big exercises in the recent past. If one thinks of extensive archaeological excavation of the former carriage and wagon works,
Ashbury's works,
in which Marais members were heavily involved, and then there was
that's back in 2012.
Then there was Arkwright's Mill at Tude Hill,
a couple of years later. Yes,
again. A joint enterprise between knowledgeable persons in Marais and the academic side.
And then later on, that would be in 2004, 2005, 2006, wouldn't it? And then later on, Marais members had an input to the commercial excavation under Oxford Archaeology.
Yes. So it rather changed from field work on particular sites to the excavation, to large scale excavations being significant, and the field work having been done, as it were, very largely for, shall we say, the Manchester region.
That's sort of recording standing buildings.
Yes, yes. The importance then was the fairly large scale excavations to secure what was below ground.
I think that might be a suitable point to conclude. David, thank you very much for your time. I suspect it's probably time for some tea and maybe cake, which is something David and I usually do when we're out field walking.
I don't think you get any cake today.
A shame.
Unless something's coming the same as we order.
David, thank you very much. Much appreciated.